okay?
Wonderful. Thank you, Joe. So good morning, everyone. I am Patty Cushing. I am a director in NFA's Compliance Department. I oversee some of our examination teams, and I'm also responsible for training the examiners who go out into the field and visit you. And then at the end is Christina Driscoll. My colleague, Christina, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Christina Driscoll. I'm a manager in examinations. I am the person you deal with during an NFA exam. I oversee the entire exam team, and I am the one that does the ultimate review on those exam reports that I'm sure you all love.
So before we get started, you know, show of hands, who has been through an NFA exam and lived to talk about it? So this is good, very good, and I saw several of you who did not raise your hands. So this first part might be more interesting to you, but we're going to kind of go through the process, and then we will get into the NFA exam, common findings and how to avoid them. We do want this to be interactive, so we are going to just take questions throughout our presentation. If you are asking a question about something we have planned to talk about, just expect my response to be, we'll get to that. But for the most part, we'd like to keep it interactive. So please jump in with questions as we go along. So the exam process. NFA has a risk-based approach to our examination process. Risk-based means two things. One, we use risk factors to help us decide who of our approximately 3,000 member firms we're going to visit next and do exams of. The second thing that makes it risk-based is once a firm is selected for an examination, we look at the particular risks associated with that firm, and that's where we focus our areas of testing on our exam. So, you know, we've got a big rule book, right? And we'll get into kind of everything we could possibly look at, but we're not going to look at that at every single firm. We're going to get a better understanding of your operations and dive into those specific areas. So for the risk-based exam selection process, we have a risk management group who looks at qualitative and quantitative factors. So first, the quantitative. They use a predictive analytics to model all of our firms, which basically just means they take all the data we have regarding all of these firms, and it helps them compare the firms and decide who might be rising to the top from a risk level. Then the qualitative stuff kicks in. Actual people start reviewing all that data, seeing what's behind it, what we know about the firm, and then deciding, okay, here's the group of firms we're going to schedule for the next quarter or 6 months or year. So that's kind of the risk-based approach. And I don't think it's too hard. I mean, you know, first of all, predictive analytics is well beyond my understanding. I'll be honest about that. But some of the factors, I don't think it's hard to understand. If we're getting customer complaints against a firm, that firm's going to be a higher risk than someone that's not. Someone that's been in business for a long time and we haven't visited is going to raise to the top. Somebody who has more complex products that they're trading, maybe they've are new and getting into digital assets. These are things that are going to raise people up. Findings from your last exam. There's nothing worse than repeat findings, in our opinion. And it has been, this predictive analytics has proven that if we've been into a firm and we had problems in an area, most times it's likely there's problems still in that area or in a new area. So those are kind of the things that are fed into this model. I should say one more thing about the risk management process and who we examine. There are certain firms that we don't have a choice. The CFTC has mandated that for FCMs who are holding customer funds, we have to visit them once a year. And the other thing is a newly registered introducing broker. There are some CFTC requirements there that we visit them in the first 6 months if they did not file a certified financial statement to get registered. But the rest of the population, we are there based on this risk modeling.
Okay.
So once you are selected to be examined, what is the process? First, it's the pre-exam work. So in most cases, unless we have some sort of indication that fraud is happening, in all these other cases, we're going to pick up the phone and give you a call and announce that we are coming. And it's a courtesy call. You know, take some time, clear your calendar, get the right people available. This is when we plan to be there. At that point, we are going to set up some calls with you. We're going to send you a couple questionnaires to fill out. CPOs and FCMs are going to receive an internal control questionnaire so that you can tell us all about your controls. And everybody is going to just get a pre-exam questionnaire. It's getting as much up-to-date information about your operations as we can get. Then we're going to set up a call with you to have you tell us about your firm. Let's clarify what's behind the data again so that we understand and can better focus where we're going to review when we are there. At that point, we will send you a document request list. This is our initial list, and it will be tailored based on what our discussions that we've been having. So where are we going to focus our testing? We'll send you a document request list based on that. And finally, we're going to ask you in this pre-exam process to start uploading these documents that we're requesting to our secure file sharing site so that we can start looking at things through this process.
Yes, yeah, we know. And I think one point to touch on, too, is due dates can seem a little scary. I understand, you know, firm operations are different across the board. Maybe you need people to approve things before you send them over. So communication is key. Just talk to your exam team. Say, hey, I know you gave this a due date of 2 days out, but can I have 4 days or, you know, whatever? I feel like we're very reasonable. Good point, John. I think I've seen this a lot in terms of the piecemeal versus doing a full upload. A lot of firms do wait because they think that's a process. We encourage piecemeal. Send us when you can. That's great because we have to continue our process. Maybe that document results in more requests later down the line. It makes it a more efficient process for everyone.
Great. So that was just pre-exam. Now the exam's actually going to start. We have your records. We've looked through them. We are going to do what we call a hybrid exam approach. This is you've uploaded these documents, and time permitting, the team is going to start going through it, identify their additional document request lists that they have, what questions they might have for you. Those initial type conversations and additional requests, that's the start of your exam. That's where we're going to start our testing and get things moving. The more that we can do before our planned field work date, the more efficient we are when we get in the field, and as John said, the quicker we're out of your hair so you can continue with your business. So we try to do as much as we can before we arrive so that field work time is very targeted and focused on what we need to be in the field for. So on the on-site field work, what's going to happen is we are going to have some interviews with key personnel. We want to actually observe your internal controls in action. So these are what we call walkthroughs, and we'll talk to the people who are performing the controls, look over their shoulders at the systems that they use, and take a transaction from point A all the way to point Z. So the internal control processes, we are going to review more firm records while we are there. Again, you know, just very quickly, when we're in the field, the quicker you can turn around stuff that we ask for there, the better. And then observe your supervisory procedures in play. So those are kind of the targeted areas during field work. Very good. So We occasionally will do remote-only exams where we won't come on site. We basically go through the same process. It's just a lot more email, a lot more Teams calls, a lot more screen sharing, things like that. So, but it's the same process. So just wanted to share that as well. And then the end of the exam, what's going to happen? So as we go through our exam work and our testing and we identify potential deficiencies, we're going to, as the exam teams, we're going to bring them up to you right away for two reasons. One, maybe the document that you gave us was the old version. It's been revised. Sorry, didn't give you the right thing. Here is our new procedure that we implemented, you know, 2 months ago, not the one that we put in last year. So it gives you a chance to correct anything that maybe we didn't identify, you know, maybe that we were mistaken. The second thing is, though, if we all... Yeah, well, that was an apparent deficiency. Yeah, we did that wrong. It gives you a chance to correct it, provide us corrective action, provide us the updated procedure or the corrected promotional material or whatever the issue is. The better and quicker that you can provide corrective action, and it's twofold. One, what is the whole purpose of this? Why do we have regulation? Well, it's to protect customers and the integrity of the markets. So we don't want you out there still doing the same thing wrong for 4 more months while we continue this process. Let's get you on the right track. And then the other thing is, if it's not that material of a deficiency and you correct it right away, maybe we can drop it from your exam report. And I know a lot of you have to report, you know, give your report to your boards and stuff, and you, the more that's handled before it gets to the report, the better for everyone. So that's kind of why we do this throughout. We are going to have an official exit interview with you that will summarize all of these deficiencies or apparent violations that we've brought to your attention throughout the process. That'll be the last time to just summarize them all. This is where we stand. This is where what we have corrective action for. This is what we still need, things like that. We will issue an exam report that officially summarizes the deficiencies, and then we will ask you for a response to that report. That response has three things. We need you to tell us the circumstances that led to the deficiency, what you've done to correct it, and then again, the actual corrective action, so the updated procedure, the corrective promotional material, et cetera, et cetera. All right. Thank you. Did you have a question, or were you good? You're good. Okay. Sorry, Joe. False alarm. Before we move on, are there any questions on the process and how this all goes? Ah, he does. I knew. I saw your face.
You felt it.
I saw his face. I knew he had a question.
No, I was going to say that as part of that, I think the thing that's very helpful is the staff looks at your size and the number of people you have in your operation, which may not be the same as Millennium. So they have different expectations of what you have in your procedures, and that's a huge help.
Thank you for sharing that. I like to hear that we've done something well. Any other questions? Audrey has here's one first, and then Audrey.
Sorry, I just was curious, for the document production when you're on site, do you need hard copies or is PDFs okay?
Everything is better if you give it to us electronically and into that system, because then we can just pull it into our audit software.
One other question, how do you think about hybrid policies at companies for on-site visits?
Hybrid policies?
Like work from home and whatnot.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to get to a section about that a little bit later, but your supervisory program has to consider how you're supervising remote employees as well. So just...
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right here.
Thanks so much. CPO and CTA members also get a management rep letter at the end of the NFA exam. Sometimes it comes before or after the deficiency letter. Could you just talk a little bit about that?
So all registration categories that we're talking about this morning do in fact have a management representation letter. It's supposed to be in NFA's hands before we issue the exam report, and it's basically just saying that you, member firm, are in writing attesting that you gave us everything we asked for, that your verbal responses were true and accurate, and it just kind of goes through all the different things. You know, we provided you with board of director meeting minutes. We provided you with all the promotion material. Yes, our pools that are 4.7 exempt, everybody in there is QEPs. So it just is kind of everything you've told us. We need to be better about getting that in the hands of our members earlier, because I know some of them want to send it to outside counsel or their general counsel to be sure that everything is in order. So I'm going to make a note to go back to my staff and encourage that. You know, some people are nervous about getting it too early, like somehow the firm is going to lie to us after they've signed the letter. I'm like, no, I still have rules that say you can't lie to NFA. So we do need to get better about getting that letter in their hands, but that's the point of it. It's similar to what CPA firms do when they're doing a certification of your report.
Yeah, I mean, guidance to our staff is mainly as soon as you get the majority of documents to send that out. I've never seen one sent after the exam report,
yeah,
but
that's
you know, that's kind of what I tell my staff too, that has that hesitance to want to wait. I said, well, if we do it now and something crazy comes out later on, we can always do another one. Or, you know, like Patty said, we have rules with lying to NFA and things like that. So we're trying to train our staff to do it as soon as possible.
Yes.
Yeah, hi. A quick question. Is there any specific requirement of how long the exam is meant to take?
I was waiting for that question. Unfortunately, there is no rule of thumb on how long we're in your firm or how long it will take. It depends on the complexity of the operations and the areas we're looking at. I can tell you that the CFTC requires us to issue a report within 150 days of the day we officially start. So this is not the pre-exam process, but the start date. I'd like to say that for the most part, it gets finished well before that, but it is 150 days by CFTC requirement.
Completed before then.
Yeah, and I don't want to make it sound like it's all on you. I mean, the fact of the matter is things ebb and flow. We've got lots of exams going on at the same time, and so our requests to you are hot and heavy those first, you know, 30 days, and we're in your face and we're there. Well, then there's a period where the staff are documenting their work, so it gets a little quieter. Then it goes a little bit longer, and the supervisor is reviewing their work, and so then questions and requests pick up again for a little bit. So there's this ebb and flow that goes through. We are not looking at your firm every second of every day for 150 days. I mean, it's just, it's a process. I think it's actually a SEG interpretation that they put out for things that the DSROs have to follow. So it's, I think, 4-1 or 4-2. It's on the CFTC's website, SEG interpretation. And it kind of tells us how to do risk-based exams and that things should be done within 150 days, et cetera. I want to clarify, again, that's for the registration categories we're talking about this morning, not swap dealers. There's totally different. And then the last thing is the report has to be issued in 150 days. Then there's that process of you responding, getting the corrective action, so that, you know, bleeds for a while. Yes.
It's along those lines, but of still, you know, the length of an audit is sometimes, you know, the beauty of smaller firms is they can be more efficient. And going through an audit, actually, I would get an email from the NFL on Monday or Tuesday. I would turn around in 6 hours, let's go like this. Then I would have to wait a full week before I got another set of questions. Is there any way to kind of speed up that, because it's kind of good to put that behind us. Not in a bad way, because it's a distraction more than anything else. But sometimes, you know, you can show efficiency on your end, and it's, how do you balance that? Is there any way to speed up, say, okay, we're very efficient. Anything you ask, you'll get in within 3 hours. You know, let's do the audit in 3 weeks and serve 3 months.
I wish. Again, it's all dependent on what they're testing, how complicated they're going to be, and in depth they are. You can certainly talk to your team about this. You know, hey, we've got the time this week or this month to really focus on you. Things are going to start getting hairy for us here, so the more you can get done, they can't guarantee it, but at least they know. And so, John, you had asked about kind of the makeup of our exam teams and how this works. We have staff examiners who are, you know, either brand new to a couple years at NFA, who are doing a lot of the testing and question asking. They are supervised by a supervisor who is usually at NFA 3 to 6 years that they've got that experience. Their job is really, they're your main point of contact usually. They're the main point of contact with the staff. They're kind of facilitating it all. Once the staff completes their work, the supervisor usually is the person to review it. Then you have Christina's level, the manager, who has been here anywhere 6 to 15, 20 years. And they have several teams that they are managing and taking care of. But they're in the field with the team for part or all of the exam as well, talking to you, understanding your operations. They're helping them, guide them. They are the technical experts of things. And then I'm the director who oversees some of those teams, and I'm just kind of the point of contact to make sure that, you know, when things are really going wrong, that we try to get them on the right track. So, all right. Well, we are going to move on then, away from the process, to the common exam findings, and we'll go through kind of the areas of testing that we do and things we're seeing and how to avoid them. And Christina is going to get us started on this, please.
Yeah, so the section that I'm sure you are all here to anticipate and make sure that these findings are not on your exam reports. So I'm just going to put this slide up very briefly. When it comes to an exam, when we're reviewing a supervisory framework, these are typically the procedures we're taking a look at. We do have other panels, like Joe had mentioned earlier. The ever-evolving topic of cybersecurity deserves its own panel rightfully, so I won't speak on that. And then also the e-communications, order communications, record keeping will also be a separate panel. But these are the ones that we look at the most when we do our exams. So developing an effective program. So one of the things that I see the most is that firms aren't necessarily tailoring their program to their operations, right? This could be a one-person shop doing procedures that make it look like it's a multi-level organization. And it could also be the opposite, right? A huge CPO, for example, that looks like only one individual is doing everything, right? Of course, we want you to follow our rules, our interpretive notices, but I think we give a lot of flexibility to make sure that you're looking at your firm. You know your firm the most. You know how your operations are. What works best for you doesn't make sense. And that's something that I think we see quite a bit. So when you're going through those procedures, make sure that that's kind of the focus. Are these procedures effective for my operations? Does it make sense? And another thing, too, is I've seen a lot of outdated procedures. Our industry, these topics are evolving. They're always changing. And your operations are changing. So making sure that you update those, like some of the things on the slide, our new systems, lines of business, new branch office, the remote or hybrid operations. I'm sure we all had joys updating our procedures during the COVID-19 pandemic. Turnover, what happens when a key person leaves? Who's taking on that new authority and those supervisory roles? And what can you actually accomplish? Looking at these procedures, they may be very, very robust and they sound great on paper, But is it doable? What's doable for your firm? So you have your written supervisory program, right? It's robust. It's great. But what are you doing to implement that? And that's kind of what this is getting at. I think a lot of member firms have those written procedures, but they don't have the documentation to support that they're actually implementing what they say they're doing. And I think a lot of member firms are doing these things. They just don't have that written audit trail, right? And I think it starts with the procedures. You know, documenting how frequently your review is conducted. Is it documented? How is it documented? Is the firm following it, right? Doing that supervisory check to make sure that your other staff are completing these things timely and efficiently. And what is the escalation process? What happens when things go awry? Are the appropriate people communicating through the channels to maybe decide whether or not your supervisory framework should change?
Nice. And there's going to be a theme today of having documentation to demonstrate compliance. So
we are
here
regulators.
We are.
We
so here's some ways to do that, Christina.
Yeah, so these are some of the things that we see during our exams. It could be logs, whether that's doing ISSP training or monitoring for suspicious activity. Email chains, whether that's reviewing procedures, approving procedures, spreadsheets. I know everyone loves spreadsheets to do a lot of their record-keeping supervisory stuff, and any correspondence relating to an inquiry, if that's customer complaints or maybe, you know, you did bylaw 1101 due diligence, right, and you have a participant that says they're exempt from registration. Do you have that kind of further back and forth support to make sure that you're in compliance?
Thank you. I think there's a question.
Does the NFA recommend like maintaining like a log of every kind of supervisory incident? Because a lot of these documents can be stored in different places. Like for example, a supervisor might Bloomberg message somebody about something else while another review might be done in a formal kind of alert system. So I guess with the logs bullet, is the NFA recommending keeping some sort of specific log of every single supervisory incident in one centralized place?
You know, if you can find it, it works.
That's the problem.
Okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, if you can't find it, then it's time to improve the system of how you keep it. Because it is, like Christina said, we're going through your procedure. It says you're doing this. Did you do it? Show me that you did it. So it's just a matter of can you find it?
Yeah, I mean, if that's what works best for you and your firm, great. But it's definitely not something that I think we would recommend or require.
Yes, it takes you, you know, 3 hours to find one request from us. That's, you've got other work to do. You don't need to be spending your time on that. All right. So then let us move to what is a relatively new rule for NFA, which is our third-party service provider rule. This basically says that if you are using a third party to provide, to basically take over a regulatory requirement of yours, then you need to perform due diligence on them. And so quickly, what does that mean? You know, the interpretive notice says you have to do an initial risk assessment, kind of look at the function. Does it even make sense to outsource this? Am I outsourcing it to someone who has authority or has expertise in this area? It's better than my expertise. It would cost too much for me to figure this out. Whatever it is, you know, do a risk assessment. Can we afford for this to be done by a third party? Then you have to do some onboarding due diligence. Again, how did you select this party? How do we know that they are, in fact, qualified and experts in this area? The third component is ongoing monitoring. It's not okay to hire a third party and then get all set, we're done. No, you have to keep watch, you know, keep monitoring, supervising what they're doing, do ongoing due diligence. For example, if they have access to your systems or access to personal identifying information of your clients, maybe you should be checking that they have a SOC 2 report that has that is, you know, has good controls over your data. So things like that is ongoing monitoring. We ask you that when you enter into these agreements, first of all, that they're written, and that the written agreement actually contemplates what's going to happen to, when you terminate the agreement. What's the exit strategy? How do you get, you know, cut off their access to information? Are they going to provide you with your records so that you have them once the relationship has ended? And then finally, of course, record keeping, our theme of the day, making sure that you do, in fact, have records that demonstrate that you've done each part of this process. So what we're seeing on exams is this rule went into effect in September of 2021, and the rule specifically said that for any new relationship you establish after that point, you have to apply these procedures. So a lot of times we come in, we don't have any new third parties, so we didn't do it. Well, you do have to do ongoing monitoring, so you need to be doing that part. So we're seeing that people just completely ignored the rule because they don't have any new third parties. I wouldn't do that. And the second thing is when the rule became effective, it said new parties in any agreements that you have renewed since the rule came into effect. So if you have, you know, an annual renewal of an agreement with a third party or every 3 years and that has happened, then you need to implement these procedures. So that, those are kind of the common deficiencies. I mean, no one in this room, I'm sure, but there are certainly a faction who, what rule? And they don't have any procedures, right? Well, 2021 is 3 years ago now. Let's get with it. Get our procedures in order. But I think the more common for people who are here to listen to, because you're clearly compliance-minded, so you have your procedure, is make sure you're doing ongoing monitoring as well as any renewals kick things up.
Can you tell us what qualifies as an outsourced regulatory function for purposes of the rule?
So it's anything that... I don't know what registration category you are. Why don't we ask that?
So we are a CPO. So, for example, we can file a form PQR ourselves or we can outsource it. But, for example, our financial statements have to be audited by an external auditor.
Yeah.
So do they both qualify as outsourced?
No, your CPA who does your certified financial statement, that is certainly someone I hope you had done due diligence on and things like that, but it doesn't. This rule doesn't apply to your CPA. It's things that you as a CPO are required to do and you have outsourced it. So the PQR filing, your administrator who is issuing your, you know, doing all of your accounting and issuing your account statements, that is for sure a third party that falls under this. Those are your main ones as a CPO. Anything else? Okay. Yes.
Yes, a follow-up question. There are some market infrastructure that we need to work with, clean houses, swap data repositories. There are some market infrastructure vendors that we work with. We have to work with clean houses, clean members, CEFs. Swap data repositories, custodians, the big ones, do they classify fully to the in this room?
Again, I don't think those are things that you as a member have to do to meet the rules. Those are things that you do to operate. And again, things in this rule make sense, right? I mean, you want to do due diligence before you send your money off to a custodian and things like that. But to say we had to follow this specific rule, not necessarily. It's the things that you have to do yourself that you choose to have a third party do on your behalf. So a CEF, you can't do that yourself. You need them. Okay. All right. Great questions. Okay, registration is another area where we will focus on our exams, being sure that you have the right people registered as associated persons and that you have branch offices listed. These two areas are frequent deficiencies. One, not so much that the person who's on the phone soliciting, you know, obviously they need to be associated persons, and you're good about that. It's that everybody in the supervisory chain of command needs to be a registered AP as well, and so it's anybody who is supervising registered APs also needs to be an AP. So that's where we see some common deficiencies. The second thing is listing branch office locations, and I just wanted to quickly review, especially with the question about remote offices and hybrid work environments, et cetera. A branch office is any location where that is set up to do business where APs are present. Now we have an exception, especially since COVID. Everybody's working from home at some point. So if the location it has a single AP or a family relationship, you know, there's a lot of those in this industry, you know, dad and son are working together, mom and daughter. So if they're living in the same home and that's where they're working, then that's an exception too. But basically it was set up for the home office. You've got the single person working from home who does not hold that location out as an office of the member. So it's just a hybrid work environment or a personal address where they, you know, are on the phone and doing emails, but not where they actually hold it out to the place as a member. The other exceptions are you cannot meet in person with any clients at that location. And the last thing is that all of the records that are required to be maintained are maintained at a listed location. So that means, you know, when they're working from home, they're using your systems that are being collected on your mainframes, et cetera. Okay, question.
Yeah, I just want to be very clear here. You've used the word home several times, but I don't think it mentions home in any of the published information.
A place where it does say something like you live, rent, or lease. So,
right. So it could be an office space where you have an individual.
A single AP
Understood.
Office space, yes.
But we don't want to confuse it by mentioning home.
I was getting to that. Thank you for clarifying my presentation. Anybody else?
Hey, Patty, we've got one more.
Great.
Or two more.
Does the branch office also for foreign APs?
Say that one more time, closer to
For foreign APs?
You mean
we have...
If they're located outside of the U.S.
Yeah.
And they're doing business with U.S. persons?
Yeah. Would, if they're, like, at an affiliate location, would that... that affiliate location outside of the U.S., would that constitute a branch office?
Potentially. If they're meeting with customers or handling customer funds, then it needs to be a branch office. And there's nothing that says, I've listed this place as a branch office and maybe it did meet the requirements. I'm not going to come in and tell you to get rid of it, but you have a few extra requirements if you list a branch office. But let's remember, you always have to supervise these remote employees, right?
Yeah.
So whether you call them a branch or not, the ultimate supervision is what's really important. And there's a question over here.
One over here.
So for the term solicitation, how broadly are we construing that? Is that tied to specific transactions or even a specific strategy? Or is it as broad, you know, broad enough to capture, like, just you know, making the introduction, saying, you know, what our company does, and then passing it off to an AP who would be more, you know, involved in, you know, actual, you know, strategy and, you know, transaction-specific communication?
That's a very slippery slope. I would say that all of that would be an AP. I would not want to be the person responsible for supervising that first activity and being sure that they stop in time. you know, soliciting is soliciting your business. So, you know, trying to get customers interested in you, talking about your strategy and transactions clearly is an associated person, but even just getting people interested in your business can be an associated person, and I would be personally uncomfortable trying to figure out where that slope stopped.
Just for clarity on your comment about multiple APs in one home, like this is something we're thinking about in our business because FINRA's recently changed some of its relief around that. We have situations where you have like a couple who are living together who are both APs or even a family where, you know, just an adult child living at home and you've got APs of three firms. So just one clarity on that comment about multiple APs living together.
I mean, the rule says that if you're in a family relationship and you lease, rent, live in this location together, you can exclude it. Again, I'm going to say you as the compliance officer can decide whether or not you want to list it as a branch office, even if you think it might be close to the definition. The only difference between a branch office and not a branch office, from a regulatory standpoint, is that you have to do annual inspections of a branch office. But you still have to supervise these people all the time. So,
just one more quick question on this. If you've got two APs in a location, but they're APs for different legal entities, can they be treated as separately in that location?
Technically, for each, because each entity lists their AP, so you can, but it's a slippery slope.
Gotcha. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Registration. Going once. Moving on. Promotional material. Still a big area of focus on examinations. And promotion material is everything. You know, it's basically communications with the public. So what are some common deficiencies we're seeing there? When you are discussing potential profit opportunities, you must have an equal discussion of the risk of loss. It is not okay for an email, a presentation, a tear sheet to go profits, 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 opportunity, 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 and have one tiny little disclaimer at the bottom that says there's a risk of loss in trading futures. It has to be an equal discussion. So that's our balance thing. The other is just misstatements, omissions of fact that cause the material to be misleading. I mean, we understand this is promotional. So we know that, you know, you're trying to drum up business, but, you know, don't lie. Say what you mean, and if there's something important to a potential investor that should be disclosed, make sure it's in there when you're talking about things. And then disclaimers, you know, everybody in this room, I'm sure, you know, thought about getting a tattoo at some point in their life that said past performance is not necessarily indicative of future results, right? We say it all the time. So just remember, if you present performance, that you should also have a disclaimer. We have seen a dramatic uptick in the use of hypothetical performance results. And so with that uptick, we are seeing some very common deficiencies that we want to bring to your attention. One, when you use hypothetical performance, it has to be very clear that it's hypothetical. If you are a 4.7 exempt CPO or CTA, you might be combining, we've only got actual results for this past year, but let me show you how the hypothetical results might have happened, you know, if we had started our pool earlier or our program earlier. Make it very clear this was hypothetical and now we have actual. So making it very clear what is hypothetical versus actual. The rule, I would go on for an hour of everything that the rules require with respect to hypothetical performance, so I am just highlighting here the issues that we are commonly seeing. disclosure of material assumptions needs to be in the promotional material that includes hypothetical performance results. So that is, what account size did you use? How did you determine entry and exit points? What's the fee structure applied? Things like that.
I guess my question is around with the hypothetical or promotional materials. Doesn't it get submitted before we can actually use it?
Not promotional material.
Okay.
It's your choice. I highly encourage you to use NFA's free pre-review promotional material service. If you are first deciding to put out some promotional material with hypothetical performance in it, send it to NFA before you do, and we'll be happy to review it and give you some tips on, you know, what material assumptions we think are missing. You need to beef this disclaimer up and things like that. I mean, it's a great way to avoid the deficiencies, but we do not require promotional material to be filed with us unless you've had some disciplinary action in the past that required it. Hypothetical disclaimers, there's verbatim language that does need to be in your promotional material, and it needs to be nearby the actual results. So can't be on page 32 of that presentation when the hypothetical results are on pages 2, 3, 4, 7. So it has to be nearby. The performance does need to be net of the fees that you are offering for your program. And finally, I can't believe we have to say this, you have to have support for these performance numbers. They can't just be, I think it might have been 7%. We actually have to see the trades that you placed hypothetically. Was it open at the end of the day? What's your OTE as a result? Did it close? Is it realized? What were those prices that you put it in at? I mean, basically, you're doing a carrying broker statement at this point, telling us what all these trades were and all of that and the fees. So we need support. That is hypothetical performance. Yes, sir, up here. I'll repeat your question.
So it wouldn't be an issue if your existing disclaimers don't account for hypothetical performance. You wouldn't see that as a gap.
So the question is whether or not we would see a difference between your current promotional material and the hypothetical.
No. If the existing disclosures that a firm has are not broad enough because you have hypothetical disclaimers, and I'm just wondering, it wouldn't be an issue if existing disclaimers don't already account for hypothetical performance.
Well, unless you have hypothetical performance. If you put hypothetical performance in your promotional material, you have to use the verbatim disclaimer. So I don't know what's in there existing.
So if it specifically says hypothetical, then it would have to have corresponding hypothetical disclaimer?
Yes.
And that's just the assumption that the existing ones are broad enough to cover it?
Correct. If you use hypothetical performance, you must have the hypothetical performance disclosure that's required by the rules. For sure.
Okay.
Yes.
Good morning. If you establish a trading record on your own outside of creating a new CTA or a pool, how do you merge your old trading performance into a new structure? Is that possible? Or you have to just start at zero on a new firm?
If your trading program is going to materially change from what it was to what it will be, am I following your question? So you had a trading program, now you're making a material adjustment, let's say, in that program, or no?
No. Say, for example, trial and error, you're creating your own program on your own. You're
correct.
Trading underneath your individual self.
Oh, okay.
No clients whatsoever.
Okay.
Now you're going to merge that performance or that understanding into a firm.
Okay. So that's what we would call proprietary or non-customer performance.
Yes, ma'am. Right.
You don't have to – you might have a separate capsule in a disclosure document that would have your proprietary, and now here's my actual for customers. So that's one way to do it.
If you have a 4.7 exemption, you have a little bit more leeway as to how you can do it, and then it's, you know, again, similar to what we're saying, if you combined hypothetical and actual, you just need to make it really clear. This was my proprietary performance up to this date. Now this is where actual, and describe any differences. You know, maybe your account size was smaller or larger than what you're expecting customers to have. You're going to want to adjust your performance for your proposed fee structure, things like that, because I'm assuming you didn't charge your self-management fees.
No.
Yeah.
Okay, but now, to me, it sounds like you're still creating a hypothetical.
Hypothetical is the trades didn't actually happen in
right.
the market.
Right.
That's what changes you from hypothetical to
actual.
To actual.
Right. Okay, but...
So pro-forming fees, we encourage that. That does not make it hypothetical. The trades still happened.
Okay, but now you're creating it into a marketing promotional piece.
Correct.
So therefore, it's still hypothetical until you actually receive a client performance.
No, it's non-customer proprietary. Hypothetical is nobody actually traded it, period. It didn't enter, that trade did not enter the market for an account. Okay. Christy, we're going to move away from promotion material.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I've seen enough hypothetical performance in my day. I would love the break. So for CPO-CTA financial ratios, we've seen a few different things happen. I think, although it's not that new anymore, it is a newer thing. And so we've seen a couple of findings as it relates to it. I think the biggest thing that I've seen in during my examinations is firms not using that 12-month period for revenues and expenses. So if you have a September 30th, 2023 filing, it should be encompassed October 1st, 2022 through September 30th. I think I see a lot of firms just do a year-to-date. So that's something just to be on the lookout for. Ratios based on the firm itself. So a lot of things I've seen, mainly at, obviously at CPOs, is that firms use fund figures when calculating these ratios. We do that fund analysis and review during our exams. We're more focused on the financial health of the CPO, so please use your firm figures. Accrual accounting, I think we see this more at CTAs that don't have the requirement of an audited financial process. So they're using a lot of cash basis, so just make sure that you are using an accrual basis of accounting when doing this. And again, as Patty mentioned, unfortunately, sometimes we don't see the support. We would love to see the support to have the underlying figures, whether it's no support at all that we've seen, or maybe it's a very condensed view. You're just showing me the current assets and liabilities. You're not showing me the full breakdown for it to make sense. Maybe I can't figure out what the time period is. So just keep those things in mind when you're doing your financial ratios. I will briefly go over this, but I think the key thing here with notice filings is timeliness, right? As soon as you find any of the things on here relating to CPOs, you must file 5 p.m. following business day. So if your pool can't meet its margin calls, it's unable to satisfy redemption requests, the pool has halted redemptions for any reason outside of typical gates and lockups, or if the CPO receives notice from a swap counterparty that the pool operates and is in default. So I think the biggest thing here is just timeliness. As soon as you find these things out, make sure that you're notifying NFA.
So these are big events, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is things are not going well, and this happens, and we have to inform NFA in a very short time period. You do this online through our systems. It's the system called, I think it's EasyFile Notifications. Take a look at it today. Go in and make sure you know where that system is, that you know who has access to file something through it. You know, you don't want to find yourself in one of these emergency event situations and you don't have any idea. That's not the time to figure this out.
So plan ahead just so that you know in the back of your mind what you're going to do if something like this happens.
We actually have a question over here. We'll bring a mic over to you. Just a sec.
Thank you. I just want to go back to the ratios for a second. In some instances, there might be a pool operator, and there's an investment manager, and I guess the pool operator. Do the ratios encompass only the pool operator, or should they also encompass the investment manager?
It can be whichever you choose. There's a way to tell us if you're doing this as a combined ratio or if it's for the member, okay, usually, so whoever that is. But if you choose to give it to us enterprise-wide, you just tell us that.
Because sometimes the investment manager might bear other expenses.
Right.
Okay, understood.
If you're putting a pool into liquidation, so you stop redemptions, does that fall into that third bucket?
If that's the normal process that you're following, no, it does not. It is, you know, something critical happened and we're just halting. We plan to operate again in the future kind of thing.
It's all good. Luckily, I haven't experienced this yet, but what kind of interaction or communication can the member expect from the NFA after they've made one of these filings?
Depends what you have filed. You know, if you just do the filing and don't upload, like, an explanation of what's happening, how you communicated to your limited partners about it, you can expect us to reach out and ask for that. If it's all clear and fine and we know what's going on, you know, if it's like, you know, half the industry has experienced this, then we probably know what's going on. But our analysts will just reach out to try to understand more what's happening.
Okay, great. So on to exemptions. I think, for the most part, especially everyone in this room, you guys are all aware of the exemptions and take full advantage if it relates to your firm. I think some member firms lack to maintain support to make sure that they are in compliance with whatever exemption they have chosen. Whether that's a qualification of investors, making sure that if you are 4-7 that they are QEPs, or trading limitations, you know, if you have a de minimis exemption, making sure that you're keeping track to make sure that you're within that threshold.
So, that's a great tip. We lose a lot of people in March who have failed to affirm, and then there's this big panic, and the Info Center gets a lot of calls, and it's the only thing you can do is refile your exemption. So stay on top of that. That's great.
Okay, cool. So in terms of pool financial reporting, I think a lot of the exams that I go to are big CPOs. So these are the things that I'm seeing quite a bit. Account statements obviously are a huge part of being a CPO, right? You need that kind of disclosure to your investors so they know how they're doing in the pool. Some of the things that we've been seeing is that those account statements do not include the pool as a whole, that statement of changes in NAV, net asset value, making sure that not only is their individual investment included, but also the fund as a whole. And then also series and class information. If you have an investor in a specific series, that series also needs to be added into that account statement. It's something we've been seeing quite a bit, so just make sure that if you are using an administrator, to have that conversation with them as well. Sometimes administrators don't do it for every single client that they have, so just have that conversation. Another thing that we see is an incomplete or missing oath or affirmation. Just to run through that, you have to have a signature by somebody that is duly authorized to bind the CPO. If it is the receptionist at your firm or somebody that has no idea what's going on, that's not an appropriate person to put on your oath or affirmation. We want somebody that knows exactly what's going on and can affirm and attest to what's being presented. The signatory's name and capacity, hopefully that is included, right? The CPO's name and the pool's name. In terms of just the financial records of a pool, some things that we see too are just liabilities not being accrued. If this is a CPO that maybe isn't using an administrator, that's something that has come up. So just make sure that that documentation is in place, your accrual records are in place, and your schedules to make sure that there aren't any unrecorded liabilities. Internal control. So we love these, right? They're a huge part of what we do, and during our exams, I think it takes up most of our field work time. We conduct those walkthroughs. We want to make sure that everybody who is responsible for those controls are present to have those conversations. Unlike a supervisory framework, we've kind of seen the opposite, where I think a lot of firms know that this is a huge risk, right? And so they are doing these things. They have implemented it. But we have seen lack in the actual written internal control framework. You know, maybe they just have accounting procedures, you know, randomly throughout their compliance manual. But it's not covering all of the very important design controls for internal controls, be it separation of duties, and kind of going through those processes, counterparty due diligence, our due diligence of your administrator, things like that. So just make sure that if you are doing these things, document them, right? And then are your controls effective? That's the main part of what our walkthroughs are. You know, we read your written controls. We send out a very beautiful internal control questionnaire during our exams where you can fill out your process, right? And during those walkthroughs, during our testing, we're making sure, is it a reasonable control for your operations, and are you doing it, right? So, again, making sure that there's knowledgeable employees, that the people that are doing these controls are educated in those specific components, making sure separation of duties exists, effective use of IT, right? I think technology is huge in this. A lot of controls are automated nowadays, and just making sure that you're still supervising that in case something were to go wrong. And then consistent application, right? You have this great internal control framework, all the bells and whistles, but if something goes wrong, you sway away from it, right? We want you to make sure that it's consistently applied so that in the event that something happens, you know how best to mitigate that. And going into that is a criteria for investigation. Something did go wrong, let's say. Did your controls mitigate it? Did it catch it before things went awry? And if it didn't, now's time to look into your internal control framework and decide what to change.
Controls.
Nice. And when I'm looking at whether or not a control is designed effectively, all these things that Christina and John talked about are important. I look at this does the person who's performing the control know what will stop the transaction from moving forward? It's not just a rubber stamp. They actually do understand what the purpose of the control is and when they need to stop a transaction from moving forward. So when I'm doing my walkthroughs, I'm talking to the person performing the control, and if they're just like, I don't know, then that's not an effective control. Thanks, John. All right. Let's switch to IBs and FCMs for a minute and talk about net capital. This is their financial statements and things that we see not done perfectly on our exams, so some common deficiencies here. You know, it happens more with IBs than at FCMs, thankfully. Our FCMs are usually in pretty good shape. But current versus non-current assets is a big thing. When you're looking at regulatory capital, it has to be current assets. And it's not the same definition as GAAP. For capital purposes, it is, can this asset be turned into cash quickly? And pretty much receivables are, we expect to get the receivable within 30 days. If we expect to get it within 30 days, then it's current, especially commissions from our FCM, commissions from our customers. Aging comes into play. If we had expected it within 30 days, but it didn't quite make it, then at 30 days we have to move it from current to non-current. One thing to think about is we expect to get it within 30 days. If you have a relationship with someone who consistently pays you on day 45, then you didn't expect to get it within 30 days, and it should be considered non-current right off the bat. One of our guidance says that instructions say that prepaid expenses are automatically non-current. We see that as an issue. And receivables from affiliates can only be current if secured by something readily marketable. So usually those are non-current. Just like Christina mentioned, with respect to the pools, we do see that the IBs are not accruing for their liabilities. This is simple. You know, most people don't understand accruals as when I incur the expense, I have to post the liability. I can't wait until the invoice comes, which might be 2 months later. I've incurred the expense. I have to accrue for it. And then haircut charges. These are the reduction of regulatory capital based on what the asset is. So if it's a security, there's a haircut. If it's in foreign currencies, there could be a haircut. If it's proprietary trading, there could be a haircut. Common overdue items. We're heading to London next week, and I plan to say, mind your calendar, like mind your gap. Watch your calendars. There's a lot of things that are annual requirements, cybersecurity training, the cyber review, AML training for IBs and FCMs, annual branch office audits, inspections that we've talked about. So ethics training is not annual. That is based on your procedure. But follow those, right? So just mind your calendar. That's the easiest thing. My most inexperienced examiner can find when something's late. So, I compared it, and you did not do it in 2022. That's an easy, low-hanging fruit for any examiner. Thanks, John. The best way to avoid common deficiencies is to do a thorough job with your self-examination questionnaire. NFA's Board of Directors put this in place many, many years ago and said that all NFA members have to supervise their business by going through this questionnaire and doing an attestation that we've reviewed our operations pursuant to this questionnaire. I can't tell you how important it is to understand and do a thorough job. I have seen firms who have done a good job with this who get a thank you letter after NFA does an exam, not a single deficiency, because they really went through this. Dan Driscoll, many of you know Dan. He's been NFA's, senior vice president for a very, very long time. And he often says that you could take NFA's self-examination questionnaire off the questionnaire and say NFA's audit modules. It's exactly what our examiners are looking at. So if you do a good job with it, you can identify where you have deficiencies in your own operations and fix them before we get there so that you can be in compliance. If you're a smaller firm, so not everyone can, be John Rushton. If you're a smaller firm, don't presume that most of it's not applicable to you. If you see something that you don't understand and think, this can't be something I have to comply with, pick up the phone and call us. The Information Center phone number has been scattered through today's presentation materials. Definitely call us and talk to us about your operations and does this apply to me. We would rather, again, you be proactive with this than assume and find out during an exam that it wasn't something that you should have skipped. Yeah, and the more, again, we're all about our documentation and record keeping, the more you can say, I talked to Christina Driscoll on this date and she told me to do that, or whoever you spoke to. That's very helpful when you're navigating these things. All right, you guys have been troopers. You've been sticking with us a long time here. We are ready to move away from common deficiencies. Are there any more questions on anything, on the exam process, the deficiencies that we've discussed?
Are there any emerging risks that we should know about, like a deficiency that has come up where the NFA's reaction was like, oh, we haven't seen this before, or oh, this is actually a bigger issue than we've realized?
The next section, digital assets. We try to be proactive, right, and identify what the next thing is, and this is definitely an area that we are all learning together, but we've got a pretty good portfolio, if you will, of firms now that are doing this and how we've examined them, so we will get into that. Do you have something?
Yeah, sorry, just quickly. This is a bit of a meta question, but talking about exams, just out of curiosity, how does the NFA review their examiners and work out if they did a good job on an exam?
There's a ton of quality review in our process. We talked about how the examiners do things. It's reviewed by the supervisors. It's reviewed by the managers. I review the reports before they go out. Then we have a separate quality control process that picks a selection of exams to look at and on a bigger basis to be sure we're being consistent across the board, et cetera. We've got quarterly feedback for all of our examiners. We do encourage members to dialogue with the director on an exam if you're having a particular good or bad experience with an exam team, to talk to us about it so that we know and can, you know, teach them appropriately. Because when you have, you know, I said I'm responsible for their training. When you have 100-plus different examiners and teams out there, you do your best to keep them consistent and knowledgeable, but we always don't know, right? So hearing from members is wonderful. We encourage it. It's not punitive to you. It's not punitive to the examiner. We just need to help them understand.
Yeah, I just recently got advice from a member firm for an exam that I could not attend. It was very positive feedback, but I encourage that. I would want a member firm to tell me if my staff weren't up to par or pressuring you to get documents too fast. I mean, that's where I come in, that's where Patty comes in, so that we can kind of circle back and say, okay, hey, like, loosen the reins a little bit on this firm. They want longer deadlines. That's what we're here for.
Okay, we will talk about digital assets a little bit. We have had for quite a while this interpretive notice 9073, which talks about kind of disclosure requirements. Depending on the registration category, you have to get certain things in your clients' or customers' hands if you are involved in digital assets. CPOs and CTAs are kind of where we're seeing it the most these days. It's all well and good if they're doing digital asset derivatives, you know, on exchange things. We kind of consider that, yes, there's a little bit more disclosure, but that's an on exchange product. We know what risks need to be disclosed in general for on exchange products. Where it's getting, where everyone struggles is when the CPO is investing in the actual digital asset. And what is the disclosure that needs to be there? And how are they protecting things? So there is a more verbose disclosure required when it is spot transactions as opposed to the derivative, on exchange derivative contract. We passed fairly recently NFA Compliance Rule 2-51 that we feel overall our current rule set just works. Doesn't matter what our members are invested in, it pretty much works. You know, promotional material rules govern communications with the public on what you say, or disclosure document rules say you got to disclose the risk. We've got all sorts of, you know, reporting concerns for CPOs and CTAs. Those rules exist. So So we just wanted to make it really clear to our MFA members who are invested in digital assets that you can't commit fraud. So we have 251 that kind of pulls together all of our anti-fraud rules, our just and equitable principles of trade rules, our disclosure rules, our supervision rules, and says if you're an NFA member and you are dealing in spot markets of Bitcoin and Ethereum, which are the contracts that have derivatives on them, so they are very clearly considered commodities and in our world, that you have to obey the anti-fraud and just and equitable principles of trade, et cetera. What we're seeing on exams. You know, as many of you know, when we do a CPO, we send independent confirmations to your custodians, to your FCMs, to your banks, to be sure that they can confirm, independently confirm, that they have your assets in your pool's name. It's more challenging in the cryptocurrency digital asset space. We are dealing with unregulated exchanges, you know, and trying to get them to confirm that they have the pool's assets, trying to be sure the assets are, in fact, in the pool's name, all very challenging for us, but we have made it work. We have figured out there are firms that have been able to demonstrate to us that this particular item on the blockchain belongs to this pool. So that's been interesting. The valuation of these things, there's only a couple of third-party admins who are even willing to touch it, so we're dealing with kind of that and what their process is and understanding that. There's a slew of cybersecurity issues here, maintaining control over your wallets and keys and making sure that the right traders have access to it and only those traders, and we don't lose our assets. Promotional material, there's been an interesting trend lately of making it clear who is dealing in the digital assets. Is it the NFA member or is it an affiliate? They're kind of blurring the lines, and so customers don't really know who they're doing business with. So that is something that we are currently working very hard with our members who are in this space, trying to get that cleaned up so that it's clear. And so, yeah, risk management and controls is kind of the big area that we continue to work with them. I would expect to see further interpretive guidance coming out from us over, you know, as this area continues to grow and more of our members get involved. The more we're seeing, the more we're trying to, you know, be ahead and let everybody know of things that would be best for customer protection. So that's where we are. You need a break, I know. Are there any last questions for this panel? I want to thank John again for joining us. We really appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to share your thoughts with the audience. Christina and I will be here the rest of the day, so if you didn't want to raise your hand in front of everyone and have something you want to talk to us about, please don't hesitate to pull us aside. We'd be happy to answer any questions you have. And thank you.
And we'll take just a 15-minute break and pick things up again at 11:15.
I forgot to read my disclaimer, but I'm sure it's not a big deal.